This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, Americans are facing a never-before-seen rush to build more than 120 new coal-fired power plants. Across the country, in federal and state courtrooms, environmental groups and concerned citizens are putting coal-fired power plants on trial, too. Coal is already the largest source of air pollution in the United States and causes 21,000 hospitalizations, 38,000 heart attacks, and 24,000 deaths each year. Coal is also the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions. Join Public Citizens Coal Block Campaign and others for a coal moratorium conference Wednesday, February 27th from 2 to 6 p.m. and Thursday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Bering Memorial United Methodist Church, 1440 Herald Street, Houston. You can also join us for a demonstration Thursday, February 28th from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. in front of the George R. Brown Convention Center. For more information, visit coalblock.net.
KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Indeed it is, and Deborah is not here this evening, and neither is Jack, and neither is Jennifer. Where are they?
I don't know. I guess old folks home? No, I'm just
old folks home.
I don't know. Phyllis Fry roast tonight.
Yes, they're off roasting community icon Phyllis Fry.
Uh-huh. So it's just the kids in the studio. It's me, Brian with an I, Erickson.
Brian with a Y, Lavinka, and I'm not a kid.
I still like to think of myself as a kid.
I'm in my 30s.
I'm almost 40, but compared to the rest of the gang.
That's right. And I'm Glenn. And we're going to have fun because the show is ours tonight.
Yes, what are we going to do?
we got a loaded show. So let me tell you about what the show's on tonight. He's a performance musician, songwriter, teacher, and recording artist. His style is jazz, traditional, and contemporary American, and even campfire folk songs. Martin Swinger is performing in Houston around Valentine's Day, and J.D. will be speaking with him. The presidential primaries are coming to Texas. Yes, after most of the rest of the country has already made a decision, we get to chime in as well. Is it going to be a moot point, or is Texas going to be the choice plum, the ballot that breaks the tie? Political reporter Jeff Reed weighs in on the Dems and the neocons and what it all means for GLBT folks. In our second hour, Joan Devlin interviews well-known author Billy Clift about his book Diary of a Mad Hairdresser, which will soon be made into a film. Billy Clift is in San Francisco, and Joan is in Iowa, but they will both be here tonight. Every year, it's Mardi Gras till you drop, followed the weekend after by Let Us Entertain You, otherwise known as Louie Weekend in Houston. And that all leads up to the big Easter parade. So grab your bonnets. Our own Brian Hlavinka has a report on jungle fever. And of course, we have our regular features from This Way Out, starting with the latest queer news from NewsWrap, and that's next.
And I'm Bridget Strong.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 9th, 2008. Police in Senegal this week detained a group of men and then released at least some of them after making mass arrests in the capital city of Dakar on charges of homosexuality. The actions began soon after the publication in a popular gossip magazine of several men's photos at what is being called a gay wedding. According to different media outlets, from 5 to 7 men were released, one reportedly a French national. But up to 20 may have been arrested, and some could still be in jail. Police have not said how many other men, if any, are being held. A spokesperson told the pro-government Le Soleil newspaper that those arrested were questioned over gross indecency and marriage against nature. Authorities stress that their release does not mean that charges have been dropped against any of the men, and said that police are still searching for several others who may have fled the country. Senegal is one of the few African nations originally colonized by France that still criminalizes homosexuality. Sex between consenting same-gender adults is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Religious leaders in the predominantly Muslim country have repeatedly warned against enemies of the faith and of morality. International human rights groups are urging the government to release any remaining detainees and drop the investigation.
Six men were also arrested earlier this month at a party organized through a gay website in India. According to the Times of India, police got an anonymous tip, planted an undercover officer at the party's farmhouse location, and then conducted the raid. The story said that condoms and bottles were impounded. The website had advertised the party as a birthday celebration for the host, and the Times said that about 82 people had signed up for the event, which charged an admission fee. Police noted that the host's birthday was not, in fact, on the day of the party, but the official charge was possessing alcohol without a permit. All those arrested were released when a magistrate refused to allow the police to keep them behind bars. Ashok Roy Kaveh of the queer equality group Humsafar Trust said that there's something objectionable in the way the police, instead of going after terrorists and thieves, are going after innocent people. Besides, he added, carrying condoms isn't a sin.
In Australia, condoms were hopefully carried just in case this week as an estimated 4,000 people marched in Melbourne's 13th Queer Pride Parade. The traditional Dykes on Bikes and more than 1,000 athletes from the just-concluded Asia-Pacific Out Games headed the procession, followed by several colorful floats and marching units. A police band marched for the first time. Celebrants capped the parade with a concert in Katani Gardens. Martin Foley, a lawmaker from Albert Park, read a message from recently elected Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, saying that his government would continue to march towards tolerance, respect, and diversity.
Whether or not the Rudd administration is merely marching in place remains to be seen. His government is balking at civil unions legislation in the Australian Capital Territory that would allow same-gender couples to hold public ceremonies celebrating their big day. The territorial government announced plans in November to reintroduce civil unions legislation, which had twice been overridden by the former Liberal Party government of John Howard. Rudd's new Labor government said at the time that it was not opposed in principle to the bill, but Attorney General Robert McClellan told the Australia newspaper this week that the public ceremonies were inappropriate. ACT Attorney General Simon Corbell told the paper, however, that we will stand by our commitment to our community for the legal option for a ceremony. That is our position. Rudd's government is not saying whether it will exercise its ability to override the territory if the civil unions bill is passed as proposed, but warns that it must uphold federal legislation passed in 2004 limiting marriage in Australia to heterosexual couples.
Meanwhile, in Sydney, Anglican Bishop Peter Jensen announced this week that he and the five regional bishops in his diocese will be boycotting the church's once-a-decade global gathering in England known as the Lambeth Conference. Jensen vocally opposed the 2003 ordination by the Episcopal Church, the Anglican wing in the U.S., of openly gay and partner Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire. He's also railed against same-gender unions. Jensen said he's taking the action because other church leaders with a more liberal view of homosexuality have also been invited to Lambeth. Leading anti-queer Nigerian Bishop Peter Akinola had earlier announced that his Anglican bishops, along with those in Uganda and Rwanda, would also be boycotting the conference. But virtually every other Australian bishop criticized Jensen's statement and said they would not be attending an Alternative Futures gathering in June, being organized by Jensen and Akinola in Jerusalem for conservative Anglican bishops shortly before the Lambeth Conference is scheduled to convene. The Anglican Primate of Australia, Philip Aspinall, told reporters that, "I think the only way we can really address issues of deep difference in the life of the church is to come together, pray together, study the scriptures, and speak openly with each other. That some bishops seem willing to forgo this important opportunity is disappointing."
In another part of the Anglican world, two churchgoers were assaulted when a group of men loyal to a defecting bishop in Zimbabwe's capital city of Harare tried to prevent his successor from being installed. Bishop Norbert Kunanga was ousted when he quit the church over his traditionalist views of homosexuality. He attempted to establish his own dissident congregation by seizing the Cathedral of St. Mary and All Saints and its contents. But Zimbabwe's highest court ruled in late January that the local synod was within its rights to remove Kunanga and that the property belonged to the Anglican Church, not the former bishop and his followers. Prior to the scheduled installation of the new bishop, Sebastian Bakare, Kunanga and his followers barricaded themselves inside the cathedral. When two representatives of Bakare tried to gain access, they were badly beaten. Kunanga announced from the pulpit last December that he was leaving the Anglican Synod, claiming that senior bishops supported homosexuality. He echoed notorious comments by Zimbabwe's rabidly homophobic president, Robert Mugabe, that gays and lesbians are worse than dogs and pigs. Bakare's installation went ahead this week, but not at the cathedral. The ceremony was held instead at a local football arena.
In other news, a New York appeals court has ruled that the state must recognize a lesbian couple's Canadian marriage. The appellate division of the state Supreme Court this week reversed a lower court judge's 2006 ruling that a community college in the city of Rochester didn't have to extend spousal health benefits to an employee's lesbian partner, even though the two had legally married in Canada. The state legislature may decide to prohibit the recognition of same-sex marriages solemnized abroad, the ruling said. Until it does so, however, such marriages are entitled to recognition in New York. The New York Civil Liberties Union called it the first known decision in the country to hold that a valid same-sex marriage must be recognized. Patricia Martinez and Lisa Ann Golden formalized their relationship in a civil union ceremony in Vermont in 2001 and married in Canada in 2004. But Martinez's employer, Monroe Community College, refused to extend health care coverage to Golden because its contract with the Civil Service Employees Association didn't address benefits for same-gender couples. The contract has since been expanded to extend that coverage to domestic partners. The appellate decision would seem to require the recognition throughout the state of valid same-gender marriages conducted elsewhere, presumably including those in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. It was not clear, however, if the ruling would be appealed.
A long-awaited date has been set for oral arguments before the California Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of the state's ban on same-gender marriage. The court announced this week that it will hear 3 hours of arguments on March 4th in San Francisco. The judges will then have 90 days to issue a ruling. The legislature approved the marriage ban in 1977, and voters reaffirmed it in a 2000 ballot measure. The plaintiffs in several consolidated cases include the city of San Francisco, which fueled the controversy when it briefly conducted marriages for same-gender couples in 2004, along with the state's major queer advocacy group, Equality California, and several same-gender couples who were denied marriage licenses. They're being opposed by the California Attorney General, Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and conservative groups who argued that only voters can overturn the existing marriage statutes. Marriage equality cases are also pending in Connecticut and Iowa.
And finally, Brazil's world-famous Carnival wrapped up this week, marking the beginning of Lent in what may be the world's largest Roman Catholic country, with a queer extravaganza on the streets of Rio de Janeiro. That wasn't before the city's biggest of several Carnival controversies. An entry in one parade had planned to feature naked Holocaust victims and a dancing Hitler on its float with the theme of "It Gives You Goosebumps." After a Jewish group won a court order banning the depiction, organizers protested with a float topped by white-gowned men and women wearing gags. According to a report by the Associated Press, and with the streets already littered with feathers and sequins after 5 days of partying, thousands of onlookers applauded the Carnival-capping Gala Gay Ball as men in glittering miniskirts, evening dresses, bead-studded lingerie, and feathered headdresses sambaed down a wide avenue in a party that would last until dawn, to the appropriate sounds of ABBA's Dancing Queen.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 9th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Bridget Strong.
This is Queer Voices.
If you go down to the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down to the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please, because that's the way the teddy bears have their picnic. Time for little teddy bears. The little teddy bears are having a lovely time today. Watch them, catch them unaware. See them picnic on their holiday. See them as they gaily gad about. They love to play and shout, they never have any care. But at 6 o'clock their daddies will take them home to bed, because they're tired little teddy bears. If you go down to the woods today, you better not go alone. It's lovely down in the woods today, but safer to stay at home. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. Picnic time for little teddy bears. The little teddy bears are having a lovely time today. Watch them, catch them unaware. See them picnic on their them as they gaily gad about. They love to play and shout, they never have any care. But at 6 o'clock their daddies will take them home to bed, because they're tired little teddy bears. At 6 o'clock their daddies will take them home to bed, because they're tired little teddy bears.
Take it away, J.D.
And, yes, this is J.D. Doyle. I'm calling from the Woodlands, and this calling remote, and that was Martin Swinger. And before I welcome Martin to the show, I want to mention that he's going to be in town for two shows this coming week, Valentine's Day, February 14th. He'll be at Anderson Fair, one of our best folk venues, along with a couple other folks. I'll give that info later. And also Saturday, he's at a special house concert. So you'll want to take note of those later in the interview. But, Martin, welcome to Queer Voices.
Hey, thanks very much. I'm very honored to be here, J.D.
Okay, the listeners just heard a sample, but how would you describe your music?
Very eclectic. That's how I would describe my music. I grew up listening to... Dad was in charge of the radio, playing swing and jazz tunes. My sister and brother, older, both of them older, were in charge of the stereo, so they were playing, my sister was playing Tchaikovsky, my brother was playing the Supremes, and so I got a very eclectic mix of musical styles that I was raised loving, and so now that I'm an adult performer, I love kind of doing a variety of kinds of music. So what you heard is, you know, sort of one side of me there with Teddy Bear's Picnic.
Hey, the two shows this week both have very different formats, so what can people expect from those?
Very different formats of the kinds of music that I do. What can people expect? They can expect a little something for everybody. That's what I pride myself in, is being a very versatile performer, and that works to the advantage of the listening audience, because what you'll hear is... always something different from one song to the next. It makes it difficult for me to label myself and to market myself as a brand, because the marketing public wants to know what kind of music do you do. And all I can say is I'm a vocalist first, and a songwriter, and I love a lot of different kinds of music.
Okay, I know you've done many, many folk festivals over the years, like Kerrville, and you've taught workshops in schools, which I think is interesting. So you're both giving and teaching music. So I'm curious about the teaching end of it, and this is teaching children.
Yes. I love working with kids. I was a very inspired youngster for some reason. Well, I had was very lucky to grow in a family that was very supportive of music in the first place. So we had pianos and ukuleles and guitars around the house, and even my aunts and my grandmother taught music in school. So when we'd go for family reunions, all the kids would gather around the piano. That was part of who we were. And so now as an adult, I've always enjoyed working with kids in general. In college, I did a lot of children's theater. About 12 years ago, I was teaching theater at an arts camp, and the lady who was producing it asked me if I could possibly teach some music of some sort, and I thought, well, I could probably figure out a fun way to do songwriting. So I kind of developed a little program to get the kids involved in songwriting, and the kids responded so well to it, and the other teachers responded so well to it, I knew I had sort of a marketable piece. So now what I do is go into the schools and kindergarten through sixth grade, I'm teaching them the basics of songwriting, which is, of course, that a song rhymes, that it has to make sense because somebody's listening to it. They have to understand what it's about. And the words have to fit into the melody. But from there, we write songs based on what they're studying in class. So we're creating mnemonics to help them remember information, the way the ABC song helped us remember our ABCs. And it's very enjoyable work. The kids are so creative and so funny. I drive home laughing that I get paid to do this. So it's a real honor to be able to do that kind of work.
Well, I know you're a very out artist. Are you out when you're teaching in these elementary schools?
Well, you know, I am who I am when I'm teaching elementary schools. Sometimes the teachers will start asking me questions to get to know me, and they'll find out exactly who I am very quickly. The kids have a different approach. The kids will say, "Are you married?" To which I can honestly say at this point, no, I'm not. You know, the day that my partner and I actually do get to get married, I'm not sure how we'll respond to that from then. But so I tell them, no, I'm not married. I always eat lunch with the kids because it's just a fun downtime, and they get to interact with me and ask me questions. And often one of them will notice that I have an earring in my right ear. And that will become a topic of conversation because the more savvy kids, the fourth and fifth graders, know that there's something wrong with having an earring in the right ear. They may or may not know what's bad about it, but there's something bad about having an earring in the right ear. And my canned response is, no, it's in the right ear. And they'll say, but it's in the wrong ear. No, it's in the right ear. I just keep insisting to them that it is in fact in the right ear, and let them piece it together any way they can.
Just go to your website.
Well, they can go to the website. Early on, I had one website for all the stuff that I do, and I had the experience of a third grader who said, I went to your website last night, and she gave me the most curious look and wasn't sure how to talk to me beyond that. And I realized, she probably found out more than she wanted to know. And so a friend of mine proposed to me the idea of having actually two separate websites, which made a huge difference. So my grown-up website is www.martinswinger.com. The website that I use for working with children and family music is www.swingersongwriter.com. And so that's more focused on the children's music, and I have a note there if you want to find out about my grown-up performances, go over to this other website. And that seems to be solving that problem. The kids are always steered towards swinger-songwriter, and they're not much interested in what else is happening in my life. So I don't get those quizzical looks anymore.
Well,
but on the Martin Swinger website, it's very much about who I am, whether I'm doing a Barapalooza or singing a Pride Festival or emceeing a Pride Festival. That's all in there.
Yeah, I was going to mention Barapalooza because you definitely do adult music as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the writing that I do, I write for grown-ups. And I write for, I'd like to think that I write a lot of intelligent music and thoughtful music, nothing that's so dense that you don't get it. I'm very much about people getting what the song is about. But I definitely write for adults, and I because I'm gay, that comes out of my music. So there are several songs that I can't help myself. I have to come out with them, and it's always a lot of fun to see how people respond to it. I find 99% of the time people respond very well and very positively to the songs I do that are more out oriented. I've got some songs that simply talk about being gay politically. A song called "Hiding Out Blues" that I dedicate to all the crazy politicians that whose lives have been ruined because the media got hold of the fact that they were gay, and I think it's so sad that none of them ever just steps up and says, "Yes, I am gay, and by God, I intend to keep my job and keep doing my job." They always falter and fall and crumble, and I find that very irritating. So that's what Hiding Out Blues is about, and everybody knows these stories, and I think everybody has the same response. Why do they have to let their career crumble, you know, just because they're gay? Why can't they be honest about it in the first place?
I understand that's going to be on your next CD.
What?
I understand that's going to be on your next CD, and you've also got some wonderful CDs. One is Bare Naked, spelled B-E-A-R.
Yeah, Bare Naked. That was the brainchild of my honey bear, Brian. I had loved doing Teddy Bear's Picnic and another song written by Dale Marxer called My Uncle Walter Goes Waltzing with Bears, which was originally Dr. Seuss' story, and just turned into this marvelous song. When I read it, I just realized the double entendre in the song was too good to pass up. And so I was singing a couple of bear songs in my shows, and Brian pointed out that the bear community is out there. They're an organized community, and they don't really have music or songs that they focus around, and so I should do something about that. So I kind of collected what bear songs I had, and he came up with the genius of doing a fur-covered album. No real bears were harmed in the making of this album, but it does, in fact, have fur around the edges, and it's always a big hit wherever I go.
I understand you're working on a new recording?
Yep, working on a new recording. It's a long process. I'm actually working on a couple of recordings at the same time right now. My next album that will be coming out probably towards the end of the summer. My timing isn't always the greatest, but probably towards the end of the summer. I'll be coming out with a new album of original songs, grown-up songs. Hiding Out Blues will be on there. Betty Boop and Buddha, An Imaginary Date between two of my favorite icons. Other songs that I've written that I did some processing. My dad passed away from diabetes, and I did some processing of that. So there are some more serious songs, and like I say, Betty Boop, Buddha, and Coney Island Lullaby, some really fun stuff too, a good mix of things. The other album that I'm working on right now is one that's going to be marketed directly towards kids in schools, and it will be a whole bunch of songs that I've written with kids that are all based on science lessons, like the digestive system and the bones of the body and that kind of thing. So sort of an educational album. I'm always working on more than one thing at once.
Well, we're going to close the segment with Huggin' and Chalkin' in a couple of minutes. Can you just tell us about that song briefly?
I love how that came about. My partner, Brian, once again, had always sung to me snippets of this song about, I got a gal who's mighty sweet, big brown eyes and tiny feet, about a gal who's really large, and loving a large woman. That's what it's all about, hugging and chalking. You keep hugging and chalking so that you don't hug the same spot twice. It's a song from the 50s, and we didn't quite know how to track it down, how to find it or anything, but we just thought it was a lot of fun. One day I got on an airplane in Atlanta and ran into a friend of mine who lives up in Maine, who was headed back. A fellow named Avner the Eccentric, who was the Jewel in the Jewel of the Nile movie. He's a performer. And he and I sat on the plane talking for a while, and he said, well, you know, my wife's father was a songwriter back in the 50s. He only had one song that made it to any popularity, and that was a song called Huggin' and Chalkin'. You won't have heard about it. And I just about jumped out of my skin when he said that. So I immediately called Julie, who was also a friend of mine, and asked her, may I change two words in the song? May I make it about a guy? And she said that was fine. So we re-recorded that song, and it's one of my favorite ones to perform.
Great, great. Let me get the details of your performances. You're going to be at Anderson Fair this Thursday. That's February 14th. Find out Anderson Fair.
Valentine's Day. Bring your Valentine down. I'll sing some love songs to you.
That's at www.andersonfair.com. The show starts at 8:30. It's a Writers in the Round session with other talented folks like Ken Gaines and Wayne Wilkerson. They're a 2007 grant.
Mm-hmm.
We can't give the prices on the air, but it's cheap, cheap, cheap to get in. And then this Saturday, there's a house concert at Bruce's Loft, and I've not been there yet. I'm looking forward to it. That's at 7:30, and Bruce says you can call him for information. The phone number, he says, is really easy. If you like 501 jeans, like I do, it's 713-501-7131. So easy way to remember that. Concert's Thursday and Saturday, and Martin, thank you for being on Queer Voices. We'll see you later in the week. And here comes Huggin' and Chalkin'.
Hey, Deep, thank
I got
you
a bear
much.
Who's mighty sweet, big brown eyes and furry feet. He likes to cook and he loves to eat, and he tips the scales at 303 OG. But ain't it grand to have a bear so big and fat that when you go to hug him, you don't know where you're at? You have to take a piece of chalk in your hand and hug away some chalk a mark to see where you began one day. I was a hugging and a chalking and a chalking and a hugging away. When I met another fellow with some chalk in his hand, coming around the other way, coming around the other way. When you go to hug him, you don't know where you're at. You have to take a piece of chalk in your hand and hug away some chalk a mark to see where you began one day. I was a hugging and a chalking and a begging him to stay by my side. When a man on a battle with some chalk in his hand, coming around the other side. Oh my, coming around the other side. Babies on my wine, coming around the other side. Over the mountains, across the great.
And that was Martin Swinger. And again, he will be appearing in solo performance at Bruce's Loft. That's a house concert on Saturday, February 16th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. Seating is limited, and this is kind of a cozy private venue. It's located on Nicholson Street in Houston. And so for more information, just Google Bruce's Loft or Martin Swinger, either one, because Martin Swinger has this venue listed on his website as well. Coming up next, Jeff Reed. This is Queer Voices. And true to my word, Jeff Reed is with us.
That's right, I am here in the flesh.
You know, Jeff, I was thinking earlier that with the primary season upon us, and you know we get to vote so late in the process most of the time, it's gonna, I guess it doesn't make that much difference, but this year's gonna be different.
Yeah, this is actually really, I think, a very interesting time right now, because the change that the Democratic Party made to the primary process by doing apportioned voting so that, you know, it wasn't winner take all the time and people would come out of states if it was sort of 50-50 with kind of an equal number of delegates really was sort of prescient, because now we have these two candidates who are locked in this really just great battle. I mean, I checked the web just before I came over, and there are some calculations calculations that have Barack Obama ahead in total delegates, even after superdelegates.
Right.
And there's some calculations that have Hillary Clinton ahead in total delegates, right? So you really can't tell who's ahead right now, and they're just so neck and neck. And it means that everybody in the country, for the first time since I can ever remember, actually gets to participate in the primary process. Because, you know, when I grew up in Washington State, and we also have a relatively late primary, and, you know, by the time it came around to us, it was always kind of a done deal.
Why is Texas primary so late?
Well, it's really a historical artifact of the political system. You know, basically, since time immemorial, you know, Iowa has gone first, and then New Hampshire is gone, and then there's this sort of handful of other states. And I think the feeling has been that if you work in the small states in an isolated way, it's really retail politics. You get the effect of having the candidate really shaking hands with all the voters. They're going to the little pancake house, and they're talking to individual people, and it's not huge rallies. And so I think the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee both like the idea of having their candidates kind of in amongst the people. And so they kind of picked a couple of small states, these states that were historically early primaries, and they kind of kept that going. And so then later in the season, you get the big rallies. And the idea is, well, they actually get to meet the candidates, but it has always, of course, kind of chafed a little bit against the concept of democracy when really our presidential candidates were being determined by a small number of rural states that are very much not representative. In particular, you know, the African-American populations in Iowa and New Hampshire are essentially non-existent. So
I hope you're ready for this next question.
I always have an answer for a question.
Okay.
It may not be the right answer.
I heard today that there's a weird way that they're doing the candidates coming out of the Texas primary, and it has to do something about the number of voters that showed up in each district the last time that we had a gubernatorial election.
So this might be, so I don't know specifically what you're referring to, but oftentimes when they decide how to apportion delegates, instead of doing a census or something, because they only do a census every 10 years, and that's kind of an unfair way of determining how many people live in a given district or in a different region. So they'll look at the number of people who voted in the last large election and use that to apportion delegates.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really anything more nefarious than there isn't really an easy or great way to determine exactly how many people are in a given district, and so that's kind of a coarse measure that you can use.
And what's the difference between a delegate election and a conference? And I understand Texas has both.
So yeah, Texas is a little bit strange. There's a lot of states that do things in various ways. And you're talking about a caucus, right?
Oh, right, right.
Right. So, and this is actually particularly relevant right now with the way Barack Obama has been doing really well in caucuses. So the way a caucus works is you basically go to, like, the school or the place where you would vote, and you actually sit with people and you discuss. I mean, you have time, you know, each representative from each candidate has an opportunity to get up there and sort of pitch to the people in the room why they should vote for their candidate. And in particular in Iowa, what they do is they basically say, okay, who showed up for this candidate, who showed up for this candidate. They count the percentage of the people. If you don't get a high enough percentage, then your candidate is actually not even considered in Iowa. And then there's this big discussion amongst those that met this sort of baseline criteria.
Speaking of which, do you know about this mock caucus that's going on tomorrow?
I do not know about the mock caucus.
Okay. And I don't have the information with me. Sorry, I mentioned it.
Google mock caucus Texas and you'll probably find it.
No, it's in Houston and it's tomorrow night and it's at 7:30.
Okay.
And I know Deborah sent me the email and my printer wasn't working and I don't have it. But yeah, if you Google it.
Exactly.
Google Houston and politics.
We're always prepared here on Queer Voices because
right.
We know how to use Google and so do you. And the interesting thing that I read just before I left is there's going to be a meaningful Democratic presidential debate in Texas. Both candidates have agreed to do it. It's going to be in Austin. I can't imagine what it would take to actually get into that, right? I mean, tickets are probably going to be...
And by both candidates, we're talking Democratic.
Yeah, both Democratic candidates, right?
Because it's not really both for Republican anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is sort of interesting, you know, it is strange and kind of embarrassing for the candidate who has been kind of anointed, as McCain has, deservedly so, because he has enough delegates that really it would take a miracle, as Huckabee even said himself, for Huckabee to get the nomination. But it is a little embarrassing when he keeps losing these races, right? But But yeah, I did want to make sure that we touched on the GLBT spin here, because it's easy to get just excited and right. motivated by, you know, talking about this stuff, because, wow, you know, hey, we actually have presidential candidates, Democrats in Houston, who are talking about national level issues, and really, or in Texas, they're going to be in Austin for this debate, talking about these national level issues and trying to really win over our votes and really, you know, move us to vote. And, you know, that is really, really good news for us, because it's really important that in these primaries, when we have a lot of judges on the ballot, as we do this year, and you can see how many, if you went to the GLBT caucus endorsement meeting last week, unfortunately I was out of town, so I couldn't be there, but I think it went until like 11 o'clock at night, because there were so many judicial candidates on the endorsement slate. There's an enormous number of people, and these are, you know, these judge races may seem very unsexy, and they're very boring, and, you know, there's a lot of them, and they're way down the ballot and people don't notice them, but they're extremely important to GLBT people, because when you're a transgender and you appear in front of a judge and you want a name change, it can either be a very simple process or it can be kind of painful and cruel, and that is really up to the judge, right? And so it's really important to us. And the other thing, of course, is adoptions. You basically, for those of you who don't know, you essentially cannot, as a GLBT person, adopt a kid in Houston. Most of the people who do it go to San Antonio and get it done in San Antonio, where the judges are more favorable, because, again, it's essentially up to the discretion of the judge, and if you get a friendly judge, it can be fine, and if you get an unfriendly judge, it can be an extremely painful process and expensive, and it can just go against you for no really good reason. So it's just really important that we get a lot of people out in the primaries, a lot of people engaged and involved to go vote for these judges and get involved in the race, so that in the general election they'll again go vote for these judges and we'll get them seated, these guys who are so good on GLBT issues. And you can always, of course, go and check thecaucus.org to see who the caucus endorses, or you can check around with whatever organizations that you you know, you sort of trust and feel like they're in line with your politics, and sort of see who they're supporting as a good barometer for who to go vote for. But I'm really excited by the fact that there's going to be a lot of people in the primary. They're going to get really motivated by that. And in terms of just the logistics of doing politics, we're going to be building a great list, because all the people who go vote in the Democratic primary, then it's public information, and you can go, you know, kind of work those voters.
Should I even bother to ask if there are any Republican judges that are positive on GLBT issues?
So as far as I know, and I didn't run the screening for the caucus, obviously I'm a member, but I'm not, I'm no longer involved that intimately. As far as I know, there were no Republican judges who screened with the caucus this time. I could be wrong. There might have been some who screened late. But it is, in general, it is rare for Republicans to screen with the caucus. They usually don't even return the phone calls. Although I will say, I will give a shout out to Ann Clutterbuck, who, you know, was a caucus endorsed candidate. She's a city councilwoman, and she's very, very supportive, and you know, it was really great. Because the caucus is a nonpartisan organization, and it's really frustrating and hard to really keep reminding people of that when, you know, one party, you know, really comes out for you and really tries to help you, and another party essentially won't even return your phone calls.
And any green judges?
We've had occasionally some green candidates, by which I mean from the Green Party, not
right.
candidates who are not experienced. We've occasionally had some green candidates screen, but I don't think this year that there were any. Yeah. The one thing that people should be aware of is, essentially, all the judges in Houston are Republican. That's probably not a surprise. It's 170-some to some. And actually, Judge Dale Grzynski, who's an old friend of the community, is actually running for re-election this time. He's one of the few Democrats. And of course, Stephen Kirkland, who is himself a GLBT, and he's running again. I think he was just up. I don't remember if he's up this next time. But anyway, but Dallas actually was in a similar situation. In this last election, essentially all of the seats went from Republican to Democrat. And the expectation is that will happen in Houston very soon, because the demographics of Houston are changing. And, of course, Katrina, as disastrous as it was very good for the Democratic demographics in Houston, because a lot of people who vote Democrat ended up coming to Houston, and many of them stayed in Houston after Katrina.
Interesting.
And so that actually pushed the demographics much faster faster towards the Democratic side than people thought it would, and so it kind of more rapidly than people anticipated, this real kind of sea change in judges is going to happen. And based on the number of candidates who have put money and time and effort into this race, the expectation is it will be this time. And I think that's probably going to be borne out by the fact that if you look at the turnout in the primaries, the Democrats have had something like, it's about 3-2. There's been about 18 million, I believe, no, it's maybe more than that. But so the total, in terms of percentage, about 66% of the people who voted in any primary so far in the country have been Democrats. About 33% have been Republicans. And so that suggests that when it comes down to an election where it's a Democrat versus a Republican, if these people stay similarly motivated, then so many more Democrats will be voting than Republicans that the Democrats will expect to be doing very well. And privately, many Republicans have been saying, you know, this is an election that we will lose. Like, that is the expectation. Now, of course, there's always the game of managing expectations. So whatever happens, they're going to say, well, we did better than we expected to. Everybody knew we were going to lose because there were twice as many Democrats turning out that blah, blah. But, you know, now is not a great time to be a Republican candidate who's in a 50-50 district, or in a district that's been in a really close race in the past, because we expect that turnout will really be driven on the Democratic side much higher this time.
Or a weirdly gerrymandered district.
Well, it depends on how weirdly gerrymandered, right? So, you know, if you're one of those people who happens to be in a particularly safely weirdly gerrymandered district. But, well, and, you know, the other thing about gerrymandering that people often forget is it has an expiration date. You know, people move. And these things are gerrymandered. This sort of burned Tom DeLay a little bit, right? Like the districts were all gerrymandered, and so he gave up a bunch of his more safe stuff, and then the demographics started to move, and he became less popular politically than he had been, and, you know, it essentially cost him his seat. I mean, of course, there were other factors in play.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that basically allowed Nick Lampson to come in and win it as a Democrat. And, you know, and it made it very difficult for a Republican to win it.
Back to GLBT issues. Where do the candidates all stand now on things like gays in the military?
So, you know, the Republicans, I mean, Mike Huckabee is certainly not a big friend of the GLBT, right? I mean, he's sort of a hardcore Christianist and is as kind of affable as he can seem. You know, I don't think he harbors people ill will, but he's certainly not supportive. John McCain, as far as I know, is supportive of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know, I guess if you maybe got him in a room alone and you were just talking off the record, he might tell you something a little less harsh, but he does sort of toe the Republican Party line, as he kind of has to, especially as a candidate who's really battling right now with the far right. On the Democratic side, as far as I can tell, I hesitate to say because I don't really know off the top of my head exactly what their stated positions are, and I don't want to get in a situation where a bunch of supporters from Hillary or Obama are telling me that I'm mischaracterizing their position. But I think they're both relatively similar on it. I will say this though, you know, if you saw the logo debate with Melissa Etheridge, she kind of asked Hillary Clinton directly about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, since she was essentially involved in the administration that implemented it, and Hillary Clinton did seem to be kind of somewhat defensive about it. But I don't think Obama has been, you know, like shouting from the rooftops that he's going to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I do think that he has said a little, his position on marriage is slightly more supportive, but neither of the candidates are particularly great on GLBT issues. And, you know, that's, I think, an echo, let's say, of the previous elections where our issues were the wedge on which candidates were losing elections. And so, you know, whether it be Hillary or whether it be Obama, I will be perfectly happy to vote for a Democrat as a registered Democrat. And, you know, I don't think that's true for the Republicans. And I think that the GLBT will probably have as supportive a Democratic president in either of them as we've had before. Maybe more so, but it's hard to say.
Do you think that the log cabin Republicans can be happy with John McCain?
So I suspect the log cabin Republicans are much happier with John McCain than they are with Mike Huckabee or with Mitt Romney. Mm. I do know that they did not do an endorsement this time. They, I think, privately kind of had their hearts set on Rudy Giuliani, who really, if anyone in that field could represent the log cabin Republicans, it would be Rudy Giuliani as a very, you know, privately very supportive man of gay rights, publicly not so much. You know, I mean, when he was mayor of New York, obviously you have to tack to the left and the right to sort of please the constituents you're trying to reach out to, and during the presidential election, he tacked, of course, way to the right. But it was sort of always wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We know what he's really like because he was the mayor of New York. And so I think with him out of the race, they certainly won't endorse. I mean, if they weren't willing to go out on a limb and endorse him, I don't think they're going to go out on a limb and endorse before, you know, the sort of primary is decided, although I guess it sort of is almost decided now. But I don't know that they're going to be terribly happy with McCain.
Even if Giuliani is out of the race, sort of formally, is there still a way to influence the leading candidate's decision on who his running mate is going to be?
Well, so, you know, it's funny. Everybody loves to speculate about candidates and running mates, but the thing to remember is it's actually a pretty simple calculation. What you do is you draw the map, and you look at where your polling is good and where your polling is bad, and you try to figure out what kind of person you need on your ticket to cover your weaknesses. That is the best strategy for winning. Right. So, unfortunately, the founding fathers may not have thought of the sort of modern political system when they were designing it, because they were probably thinking, oh, you want to pick the vice president based on the fact that, you know, this is the guy who's going to
lead the Senate.
Yeah, exactly. But no. I mean, it's really, it's a naked political, it's no point in having a vice president.
Who's going to bring home the votes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No point in having a vice presidential candidate who can't get me elected if he can, you know, sort of, doesn't matter what he can do if he can't get me elected. So I don't think Giuliani really helps any of the candidates as a vice presidential choice. And, you know, Huckabee is maybe a sort of logical choice for John McCain because he's missing these conservative credentials, although, you know, there are a lot of hardcore conservatives who would love to be vice president who would just as easily buttress McCain's conservative credentials, and not all of them have been campaigning against him. So I think it'll be much easier for him to pick somebody out of the race. And similarly, I don't think that Hillary is a particularly good choice for Obama because I don't think she covers his weaknesses particularly well. And I don't think Obama's a particularly good choice for Hillary because I don't think he covers her weaknesses particularly well.
Interesting.
So I would suspect that either of them would pick someone else, although there might be great pressure, of course, to pick the opponent, in part because both candidates have done a great job of mobilizing kind of a base, and if you could bring them together and keep that whole base mobilized, then, you know, that would be great. But I'm not sure that
and there's the whole sort of reunification thing of,
yeah, although you would be surprised at how easy it is to reunify a party when both of them stand on stage arm in arm and talk about how great one is the candidate is and how much they, you know, hate the other side. So you'll see the same thing with McCain and Huckabee. If Huckabee isn't his running mate, it'll be pretty easy for Huckabee to sort of say, hey, you know what, let's all come together. And Republicans are very, very good at this. You know, they say Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line is the cliche. And, you know, like, it's really easy for the Republicans to sort of say, these are your marching orders, and as a party, that's why they've been winning, is they've been very good at following kind of a unified voice, whereas Democrats tend to be more like herding cats, and you have to kind of, you know, do more of a selling job to kind of get people to buy into it.
This is Glenn Holta. You're listening to Queer Voices, and I'm in the studio with Jeff Reed talking about the upcoming primaries in Texas, and excuse me, I have this nasty head cold thing that's been going around. When are the primaries, and how do you find out where to go vote, and how do you participate?
So I'm actually remiss because I didn't look up the primary date specifically before I left, but I believe it's the first week in March. But you
Google
can
them.
Yeah, but you can Google the primaries. If you go to thecaucus.org, they'll give you information about you know, when the primaries are and what the voting schedules are. You can also go to the Harris County Votes website, which is, I believe, harrisvotes.org, but you can Google that as well. And that'll give you, that's like the Harris County information about voting, and that's the source of information specifically for what your polling location is and what the procedure is, you know, if you want to go vote in one of the primaries, what exactly you need to do and what you need to bring with you. You know, you need to be registered to vote, so if you're not already registered to vote, you're not going to be able to vote in this primary, but you should get registered to vote because then you will be able to vote in the election that quote unquote really matters, right? I mean, this is like
after all the decisions are already made.
This is the semifinals, right? You know, yeah. You, yeah, so So, definitely, if you haven't already been registered to vote, you need to get registered to vote, and you can just go online and Google, like, Harris County Votes, or go to the caucus.org, and there'll be a bunch of information about how and you know, the voting process.
And it's just like a normal election. You go in there and you...
It's just like a normal election. You're going to go in there and you're going to go through your little click wheel on your little electronic voting machine and do your usual thing that you've done again and again and again.
Just although, as if you were actually electing the person.
Yeah. Although, if you aren't registered to vote, maybe you haven't done that before.
Right. And then what happens? Because, I mean... After it's not over after that.
Well, so it's interesting. You know, it's probably not going to be over. Now, if you believe the spin that's been coming out of the Obama campaign, he's sort of saying, well, you know, I'm going to gain all this momentum and going into Texas, everything's going to go really great for me, and I'm going to sort of lock it up. And if you believe the spin from the Hillary Clinton campaign, they're sort of saying, well, these little states, they don't really matter so much. We're going to do really great in Texas, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Those are swings, you know, those are big, big electoral states. Those are states that really matter, and you'll see, right? I'm guessing that it'll be the middle way again, and they'll split somewhat, and, you know...
Actually, what I meant was, after the primary vote that night, it's not over.
Oh, no. Yeah.
There's the whole caucus thing. What is that?
Right.
That
well, work? So I'm actually not sure exactly, I've never actually primary voted for a presidential election in Texas, because I haven't ever... had an opportunity to have a primary in Texas where there's any vote that you
mattered,
can make anything that mattered. So I'm as green about caucusing in Texas as anyone.
But
so.
They do the whole smoky room thing. And
yeah, I'm actually not really sure even because it is weird. It's not like Iowa where it's like everybody caucuses, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's part of primary and part of this caucus, and I'm not really sure how it gets split up. So that's a good question.
Something that we'll have to delve into later on, the next time that we have you on to talk about the results from primaries.
Yeah, and I'll tell you my experience of having either learned or not learned
or
how this caucusing
not, yeah.
works. Yeah.
Right. So is there anything else that we missed?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I do want to leave people with the sense that, you know, whatever your politics are, whether you agree with me or disagree with me on any particular piece of analysis, I think the unambiguous thing is it is really, really exciting. Even in the Republican primaries, because this is sort of unprecedented, having somebody who's kind of so close to the nomination, but having the underdog coming in and kind of winning all these contests. So, you know, it's a great time, and take this opportunity, because it does not always happen this way. You don't every year have an opportunity to make a primary vote that really can speak to kind of the political community and tell them something about what your community wants and what this candidate means to you. So, you know, like, go get involved in it.
And as Mike Huckabee has been pointing out repeatedly, John McCain still does not have the majority of the delegates that he needs to actually win the nomination.
No, he does not. It is not an over race.
Yeah.
He's definitely in the lead, but It's not an over race.
So get out there and participate. And,
yeah. And certainly on the Democratic side, it's so razor thin close.
And so let me just make the usual disclaimer that we're not, as a nonprofit organization, KPFT and Queer Voices and et cetera, and myself, Glenn Holt, and Jeff Reed are not actually endorsing any particular candidate or political party. We're just having this discussion about the politics and how they involve GLBT interests. And with that, you are listening to Queer Voices.
I'm gonna let me. You know I can't believe it when I hear that you won't see me.
Don't you want me?
You know I don't believe you when you say that you don't need me.
Much too late to find. Did you change your mind? You better change it back or we will both be sorry. Don't you want me, baby? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Love has never asked you why.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry?
FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
Fuzzy-faced friend of mine, it's bedtime, so lay down with me. You've had a rough day today, but now it's done, so lay down with me. When I'm feeling sorry, you know what to do. I'm here to give back what I learned from you. I'll hold you all night.
Well, that piece of music just cut out mysteriously. All right, well, we have Joan Devlin in Iowa. Joan?
Oh, hi. How are you guys tonight? I'm sure you're warmer than I am.
Yeah, I'm sure that we must be, because you must still be up to your clavicles in snow.
Pretty much, and we're getting about 6 more inches as we speak.
Wow, really? We were supposed to get thunderstorms this evening, and in fact, it may still happen.
Well, I hope it doesn't. I don't want you to get anything like Tennessee had last week.
Yeah, I know. Well, take it away, Joan.
All right. Well, we have on the line Billy Clift, who is the author of the amazing book, Diary of a Mad Hairdresser, which is about to be made into a movie. And Billy, thank you again for being with us tonight.
Oh, no problem. It's wonderful.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about your life as a mad hairdresser.
Well, it's also actually the first part of the title is called Everything's Going to Be Just Fine, which after, as you know, since I know that you've read it, it's about the last 3 months of Elizabeth Montgomery, who was my dear friend, and how it affected me after she passed in 1995. And so that's what we're in the process of doing now, is turning that into a film.
I agree that, you know, and initially, of course, being a Bewitched fan, I picked up the book because it is about Elizabeth Montgomery, and it does give some insights into her life, and it's very touching. But what the amazing thing about the book is that going through that very difficult and sad time kind of became a spiritual journey for you.
Exactly. It was totally out of left field because it wasn't something that I was necessarily into, and it just was a trigger that just catapulted me into having different experiences and questions and just trying to figure out what this all is about. And of course, as you know, she kind of visited me, you know, and it was one of those things where you're just like, going, what the hell's going on? I think you can say that, can't you? And I just started questioning and tried to keep my mind open as it kind of broke open and until I just kind of gave in to what is this all about, and understanding that I don't know what the hell anything is about, but that it's much bigger than I can possibly imagine. And then it made me look at the whole thing as good, as a positive experience, and that her passing was actually an amazing experience, and that she touched so many amazing people. She was a phenomenal being, a phenomenal magical being, and not just because of Bewitched, but just her as her own essence was phenomenal, the way she touched people.
So let's kind of begin at the beginning. How did you end up meeting Elizabeth Montgomery? Was it after, obviously, you were working as a hairdresser for movies? How did your paths cross?
Yeah, actually, it was in 1984. Of course, I remember it very well because as a little kid, I was a total Bewitched freak. like so many people.
Join the club.
like join the club. And, you know, like so many people, I think I even looked at her like my mom. You know, she was it. She was like the perfect mom. She was everything you wanted. But I became a hairdresser in 1980. And I was working at a salon in Beverly Hills, and I was all of a sudden called by the studios because I had worked with a photographer for a photo shoot, because I started doing little photo shoots for models, and I had gotten along really well with this photographer, and he said, you know, I think that you would get along really well with Elizabeth Montgomery. Would you mind doing a photo shoot with us? And I'm going, would I mind? My God, you know. And, of course, I wouldn't tell anybody I was an Elizabeth Montgomery freak, you know. But so I went and met her at her home, and it was just from then on. It was, and I was fortunate enough to call her a very, very dear friend.
And you and your partner actually spent time with her outside of work, isn't that true?
Oh, yeah. By the time, you know, and it took me a long time, actually. So, you know, from 84 on, and she passed away in 95, it took me a long time to really get into that inner circle, but that's very typical of celebrities in general, is that they're very cautious on who they allow in their realm. And I would say at least took me probably 5 years until they knew, until someone like you create real trust. And then we became like, you know, we were going out to dinner once a week. We were taking little trips together. It was just, you know, that was my pal, you know. And I felt very fortunate that I was able to have that experience as well and meet her beautiful family. I believe you've met Rebecca, her daughter, who's just,
right,
just dynamic and beautiful and a lesbian and fabulous and all that good stuff. And
aren't we all fabulous?
Huh?
Aren't we all fabulous?
Aren't we all fabulous?
So talk a little bit about, because Elizabeth Montgomery, though not as well known, obviously, as some others, did a lot of work for AIDS, particularly at the beginning of the AIDS crisis, when a lot of celebrities, even if they would participate in the events, didn't really want anybody to know they were participating. And she never went through that. She was always very open about her support for that.
She refused to not... She was the type of person who would never not be herself 100%. One of the things that I have in my movie that I made very clear when I... Because I have in the movie The Memorial, as I made quite a statement in the statement in The Memorial about how she was such an inspiration, because she taught me how not to fear being myself no matter what people thought. And she did that. She believed that even though she was a known person, that should not interfere with the fact that she's a human being with ideas, and that she felt so strongly. I mean, most of her friends were gay, and a lot of her friends were dying, and she was going to be right there, and she didn't care what people thought.
Okay, so now let's segue from the book into the movie. Tell us a little bit about the movie. The movie is going to be called Everything's Going to Be Just Fine, and it's currently in production.
We are going to be going into production in March, and that's just because we don't have 100% of the financing. We have 60% of the financing. So if anybody out there has a few $100,000, darling, you know, if you want to make a spectacular movie. And we also don't have Elizabeth Montgomery cast, and we are, and that is a really hard casting. We have a wonderful, Jennifer Coolidge is in our film. She plays my sister. We have a wonderful guy named Michael Medico who's playing me. He's kind of an unknown, but he's on every sitcom you can imagine, one of those faces that you'd know. We're going after Rupert Everett to play his best friend so that we have some stars, and then we do have a lot of unknowns. Mitch Morris, who was in another gay movie, is playing Brian, the boyfriend. Jessica Graham, who is in 2 Minutes Later, which was a lesbian cop. Fabulous movie that hit all the film festivals, the gay and lesbian film festivals this year. So it's quite a process to make a film, of course, in Hollywood, and to convince them that me, as a first time feature director, I've done two documentaries and a short. The short hit all the gay and lesbian film festivals. It's now being distributed by Iron Rod Motion Pictures out of Canada. I also have another documentary that's just getting picked up by a distribution called The Pure Eccentric San Francisco. But then it is such a difference to try to say, okay, I want to make a real movie, a big movie, with money, and then try to convince people that I can do that. So I'm just constantly going to all these different meetings over and over, constantly down in L.A. I live in San Francisco, so I'm constantly down in L.A., going to one meeting after another, and we just have to convince one more person for a few $100,000, and then we can go into production.
And how does it feel to be, because it's one thing when you write, say, a fictional book about a fictional situation or a scenario, but how does it feel to be sitting there, like, for instance, and casting someone to play you? And how does it feel to be kind of putting together a film about a point in your life that was very emotional and having to kind of bring that to the screen and sort of separate yourself from it so that you can make a good movie, while at the same time put enough of yourself in it so, of course, everything you felt can come across to the audience?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. It has been quite a dramatic experience, because I've had to, in the process first of writing a script, which I wrote myself, with a lot of help from real top professionals coming in and giving me suggestions, because I always believe that you have to bring in people who are amazing to help anything become more amazing. You always have to go to people who have experience to ask. But anyway, it's been quite an experience. First of all, to have to relive it and to feel every moment, and then to be able to try to express it. This movie it's actually not quite as broad as the book. The book was quite broad. This really has a lot to do with me and Lizzie. More so where the book kind of went off a lot. This more narrows down. It was quite something to try to find someone to be me, my God. But I tell you, it was pretty quick. I took one look at the guy and I knew that he should be me. I had to go with my gut instinct. And in Hollywood, they really do work with their gut instinct, you know. You really learn that. And it was the second guy I looked at thinking that should be Billy, and I knew he had to be me. It just felt it, you know. But yes, this has been quite a journey. It's even hard to put into words. And I'm very excited, though, about it.
So how much of this kind of ties in, because in the book, you know, going through what you went through, losing your close friend, because fans know Elizabeth Montgomery as Samantha or as Lizzie Borden or as Bellstar, but you knew her as my friend that I go to dinner with every week, this person that I've come to know personally and love. And so taking that and all the pain of that and then going on the spiritual and emotional journey from there, how has this movie kind of furthered that journey, or is that journey still ongoing? Have things changed? I mean, has it kind of just all tied together?
Yes, it continues. I mean, I don't think ever in our lives is our journey going to stop until we drop this little old body. But yes, it's a constant change. And it's what was so wild, as you know, and where we met, of course, in person was at the star dedication for Elizabeth Montgomery. And to me, that was an amazingly poignant moment, because I had not seen most of those people all in one place since her memorial. And it was this big circle. And it was quite a energetically dramatic experience for me because of that. It was almost like, something was coming full circle, and I almost felt like it couldn't have happened. I couldn't even make this movie until that occurred, until I could be with all those same people so many years later, having that experience and a celebration for her life as well. You know, such a poignant moment.
And then
that was phenomenal.
Then rain that day.
Yes, and as you know, as everybody said, Rebecca and Bob commented, is that she would get so excited anytime it rained. She would just be like, oh, thank goodness, let's go for a walk, you know? And so she was always, so that you really know that she was just supporting that rain, so to speak.
Well, we laughed because it wasn't supposed to rain, and then it literally started right before the ceremony and literally ended as the ceremony wrapped up. So that was just, of course, what do? You stand there, get wet, and you just laugh.
Exactly. And who cares? You know, what's
no,
water?
It was wonderful. And it was Johnny Grant's last time to do a star ceremony.
I know. Isn't that amazing? I got an email, actually, from Erin Murphy immediately when she found out that he passed. That was Tabitha, for those who don't know, who played Tabitha on Bewitched. And I'm definitely going to have a nice little cameo for her in the film. As well as I want to get the gentleman, I can't remember his name, I'm sure you do, the man who played Dr. Bombay.
Bernard Fox.
Bernard, yes. What an amazing actor. I want to get a nice cameo for him in the film as well. One of the maybe the only two, or are they the only two left? You would know better than I.
Well, they are, and Adam, the David Lawrence who played Adam.
Right, but it's pretty down there now. Which is very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the show came out the same year I did, so I won't tell you how old that makes.
Well, I watched the first episode on TV. I remember it. I remember it as clearly, and I was 5 years old. And I remember it. I was hooked at that moment. And I can to this day be right there at that moment. I had a cat. I got a cat right away, and I named it Samantha, and I used to force it to watch the show.
I actually have a cat that I got from our engineer, our sound engineer, Glenn.
Uh-huh.
And that cat's name is Larry Tate. So some things never change. Well, Billy, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. The book is called Everything is Going to Be Just Fine, Diary of a Mad Hairdresser. It is by Billy Clift. And hopefully the movie, Everything is Going to Be Just Fine, by the same name, will be hitting theaters. When do you think we'll be able to see it in theaters?
I would say about a year from March.
Oh, great. So hopefully by this time next year, we'll be talking about your premiere.
Exactly. That would be wonderful. Just wonderful. And thank you so much. This has just been delightful.
Thank you. And again, we were talking to Billy Clift, and you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston.
We'll hear about and from two leaders of liberation movements that preceded and probably helped inspire the Stonewall Rebellion later in the program.
Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. Shadow from the starlight is softening in a lullaby.
Our literary commentator Janet Mason had developed a rapport with the Centennial State before it became a homophobic hotbed and before the voices of its LGBT heroes were published.
I spent a summer in Boulder, Colorado in 1992, and I always expected to return. I had, after all, sat in the middle of a field studded with wildflowers, gazing up at the Flatirons, which are massive slabs of rock nestled in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains near Chautauqua Park. Legend has it that anyone who gazes upon the Flatirons is destined to return. Later that same year, Colorado voters passed the Anti-Gay Amendment 2, which prevented any Colorado government entity from adding sexual orientation to its non-discrimination policies. After much outcry and opposition, this amendment was overturned in 1996 by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1992, there was a national boycott of Colorado. Conventions were canceled, as were vacations. I, too, thought of the boycott as reason not to return. But there were other overriding circumstances. For one thing, my friends who I'd spent the summer with moved back to the East Coast. Not to mention that summers off are rare. So I returned from studying creative writing at the Naropa Institute in Boulder with instructors that included the legendary Allen Ginsberg to my daily grind of being a freelance writer. I was recently reminded of all this when I picked up a copy of Focus on the Fabulous, Colorado GLBT Voices, edited by Matt Kelly, published in 2007 by Johnson Books in Boulder, Colorado. This anthology is a quick read with snapshots of the coexisting homophobes and hippies, including gay and lesbian flower children, gender-bending cowboys and cowgirls crazy for the movie Brokeback Mountain, whiskey-drinking grandmothers and righteous drag queens, all set against a backdrop of pristine natural beauty claimed as home by the religious right and also by relentless LGBT activists. 70 miles south of the ever more cosmopolitan city of Denver, in Colorado Springs, is a modern-day castle on top of a hill that is the headquarters for Focus on the Family, an ultra-conservative Christian conglomerate with 1,300 staff and 250,000 visitors per year, described as the hub of anti-gay activism in the United States and beyond. The editor of this anthology describes Colorado Springs as Ground Zero, the name of an LGBT equal rights group also in Colorado Springs. The Colorado GLBT community, represented in this anthology of personal essays, short fiction, and poetry, interlaced with historic commentary, portrays a love of the land, a collective bewilderment each time a new piece of anti-gay legislation is passed, a fierce perseverance and determination, along with an acute understanding of oppression. Donaciano Martinez, who began his activism in 1964 on the fronts of civil rights, peace and justice, and the gay community, writes in his essay that it was his experience of learning at an early age of it not being okay to be of Mexican-American heritage that shaped his perspective. that ethnic hatred was often internalized by our people, and the self-hatred expressed itself in the form of trying to alter our cultural identity. Chicanos often changed or anglicized their names. Many tried to hide their accents, and others lightened their dark hair to red or blonde. This type of internalized self-hatred has had a similar effect in the gay and lesbian community, leading many to conceal their true identities. Martinez, who grew up in the Colorado Springs Chicano community, came out before gay liberation, when gay culture was underground, in men's bathrooms, in movie theaters, behind closed doors. He writes, "Just as I learned at an early age that it was not okay to be Chicano, I also learned that it was not okay to be gay. Just as Chicanos did not rebel against injustices, gays did not rebel against the societal hatred that kept us underground." Another notable writer in this anthology is Nuclea Waste, a drag queen from the uranium-contaminated swamps of Rocky Flats, Colorado, who writes about the kind of camping that is done in a tent, not in platform go-go boots, though both are quite fun. Carol Lee Lawton's short story, Urban Cowboy, portrays a female-to-male transgendered person who was disabled in a rodeo accident and explores his evolving self-image through the eyes of a woman who finds him attractive. "I realized that she didn't see me as a Crip. She saw me. The wheelchair didn't matter to her. Should it matter to me?" The lives and the community presented in this book are complex and multifaceted. The community's legal victories are described, the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Amendment 2, and more recently, in 2007, the law that allows for two same-sex parent adoptions that was finally passed and signed into law by a new Colorado governor. This anthology also shows the disappointment of the LGBT community at the state's 2006 constitutional ban against gay marriage, along with the defeat of Referendum 1 on the same ballot, which would have provided legal protection to gay and lesbian couples. Like most places, but maybe more than most, Colorado is a place that contains many contradictions. Despite these contradictions, I find myself remembering all of the things that I loved about Colorado: the pristine landscapes, fields of wildflowers under fierce, jagged peaks, the wide open blue of the sky, even the tie-dye. I have no doubt that someday I will return. In fact, I've already begun to do so while turning the pages. Rocky Mountain High. With commentary on queer literature and life, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out. Rocky Mountain High.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each program. All you have to do to receive one or both of these messages is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you to anyone else, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com. That's tworadio@aol.com.
A venerable change creator answers a sensitive political question after we pay tribute to another champion of the disenfranchised.
Cesar Chavez, Latino champion of civil rights, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Cesar Chavez was born in Arizona in 1927. At the age of 10, he became a migrant farm worker. He faced racial discrimination early in life. In 1946, he married a woman who shared his concerns about social justice. Driven to fight for fairness and human dignity of farm workers, Chavez founded a union called the United Farm Workers. His rally cry, Si se puede, or It Can Be Done, helped mobilize nonviolent boycotts, strikes, marches, and fasts.
In 1973, 17 million Americans joined in the table grape boycott, forcing law that provided better working conditions. Chavez championed equal rights for all, including gays. At the 1987 March on Washington, he said, "Our movement has been supporting lesbian and gay rights for over 20 years. We supported lesbian and gay rights when it was just 10 people." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Bill Lupalite.
If you see me stumble,
still a Morehouse College student in 1960, Julian Bond helped start the Atlanta sit-ins and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. 5 years later, he was prevented from taking his elected seat in the Georgia House of Representatives because of his objection to the Vietnam War, a situation that the U.S. Supreme Court finally had to resolve. He was nominated for vice president at the 1968 Democratic National Convention, although he was legally too young to accept. Now the chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, his voice is well known from documentaries like Eyes on the Prize. Bond brought those familiar dulcet tones to the 20th annual Creating Change Conference, convened by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. The civil rights warrior kicked off this year's activist gathering in Detroit, Michigan, with a speech noting the commonalities between the LGBT civil rights movement and the struggle of African Americans.
Dr. King didn't march from Selma to Montgomery by himself. He did the speech to an empty field at the March on Washington. There were thousands marching with him and before him, and thousands more who did the dirty work that preceded the triumphant march. The strategies of that movement were litigation, organization, mobilization, coalition, all aimed at creating a national constituency for civil rights. Sometimes it is the simplest of acts, sitting at a lunch counter, going to a new school, applying for a marriage license, casting a vote, that can challenge the way we act, the way we think. That's why when I'm asked, are gay rights civil rights, my answer is always, of course they are. Civil rights. Civil rights are positive legal prerogatives, the right to equal treatment before the law. These are rights shared by everyone. There is no one in the United States who does not or should not share in these rights. Rights for gays and lesbians are not special rights in any way. It isn't special to be free from discrimination. That's an ordinary universal entitlement of citizenship. The right not to be discriminated against is a commonplace claim we expect to enjoy under our laws and our founding document, the Constitution. That many had to struggle to gain these rights makes them precious. It does not make them special, and it doesn't reserve them only for me or restrict them from others. When others gain these rights, my rights are not reduced in any way. The more civil rights are won by others, the stronger the army defending my rights becomes. My rights are not diluted when my neighbor enjoys protection from the law. He or she becomes my ally in defending the rights we all share. Now for some, comparison between the African American civil rights movement and the movement for gay and lesbian rights seems to diminish. The long black historical struggle with all its suffering, sacrifices, and endless toil. However, people of color ought to be flattered that our movement has provided so much inspiration for others, that it has been so widely imitated, that our tactics, our methods, our heroes, our heroines, and even our songs have been appropriated by or served as models for others. No parallels between movements for rights is exact. African Americans are the only Americans who were enslaved for more than two centuries. And people of color carry the badge of who we are on our faces. But we are far from the only people suffering discrimination,
Sadly, so do many others. They deserve the law's protection, and they deserve civil rights too. Sexual disposition parallels race. I was born black and had no choice. I couldn't and wouldn't change if I could. Like race, our sexuality isn't a preference. It is immutable, unchangeable, and the Constitution protects us against prejudices based on immutable differences.
That was an excerpt from NAACP Chair Julian Bond's February 7th opening keynote address at Creating Change, an LGBT activist gathering in Detroit, Michigan, sponsored by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Lee Moore, Bridget Strong, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Sherry Lunn, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Bill Lupoletti contributed program material. John Denver and Sweet Honey in the Rock performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from several special CD thank you gifts. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WRSU New Brunswick, New Jersey, KUCR Riverside, California, Arrow FM Masterton, New Zealand, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
It was a long road. It was a long time. It was a long way around this stuck mind. It was a way that I was looking at the things I couldn't see. It was the way that you were looking at me. It was a late night. It was the late fall. It was a late hour to make a late call. Sometimes it takes a stand. Sometimes it's quite empirical, and sometimes it's so grand. But most of all, it needs to be a sudden leap of faith. It's a leap of faith. Well, it was a new dream. It was an old car. It was a back road and a bright star. And it was a thing. Sometimes it's about time. Sometimes the earth is shaking. Sometimes the world is mine. But most of all, it needs to be a sudden leap of faith. It's a leap of faith. It was a lifeline, it was a long rest, it was a lifelong dream and a hard test, and it was the things that I was bearing and the things I couldn't see.
simple, and sometimes it's so grand. But most of all, it needs to be a sudden leap of faith. It's a leap of faith. And this is what I know, and this is what I see. It was the way that I was looking at me.
From the album Leap of Faith, that was Trett Furey. And by the way, she's going to be in concert. It's actually kind of a house dinner concert in the Heights area. And that's going to be on February 17th. And 16th. However, there are a few tickets left for the concert on the 17th, but the 16th is sold out. However, again, because of a couple of cancellations, there may be a few tickets available for the 16th. So really the best thing to do is to contact Deborah. She's the one putting this together. So contact thedivadeb at yahoo.com, and I'll spell that out for you. It's the, T-H-E, and then Diva, D-I-V-A, Deb, D-E-B, the Diva Deb, all one word, at yahoo.com. And again, that's for the Trett Furey concert that's going to be February 16th and 17th in the Heights. This is Queer Voices.
We are about 6 weeks away from Easter, a little less than 6 weeks, and this is one of my favorite times to be in Houston, not only because of the weather, but also that we have a couple of community events going on that are raising money for the community, the first of which is Bunnies on the Bayou, which has been around for 29 years, and also Jungle, which has been around, this is our 16th year. And in studio today, tonight, we have J. Allen Presley, the president of Bunnies on the Bayou, and we have Christian Rogers, who is the treasurer of Bunnies on the Bayou, and they're going to give us some information, maybe a little history, things you might know, may not know about Bunnies on the Bayou, and all the upcoming information and details. Take it away, boys.
All right, great. Thanks, Brian, and we appreciate you guys having us on the air. Christian, I'll let you start off and give us a little bit of background on the organization.
Well, like Brian said, we are in our 29th year, and Bunnies on the Bayou's primary fundraising event occurs every year on Easter Sunday and is organized by a group of volunteers and core hosts that underwrite and put on the entire event. The attendance of our event is usually around 2,000 people annually, and over the past 10 years, we've actually raised over $400,000 for the community to include programs such as HIV food pantry, health screening for women, computer hardware and software for organizations, and then printing materials for educational purposes. So quite a few programs that we've actually been able to participate in the past 29 years.
So 29 years. Next year is the big year. I'm sure you have something huge planned for that. Tell us how this all started, this crazy party that happens on the banks of the Buffalo Bayou.
Well, like you said, 29 years ago, there were a group of people got together, wanted to have a small gathering, just have something to do on Easter Sunday afternoon, put it on a party at their place. It was a hit. Thought the next year, why don't we do this again? And they started growing from there. That was also about the time that the AIDS crisis began to hit in the 80s.
Right.
And there soon became a need in the community to help all of those suffering from the effects of HIV and AIDS. And so, therefore, they began to request canned food or some type of non-perishable food donation as an admissions fee to the event. And year after year, it just started to grow, and it really became a party that everyone would talk about. It grew outside of the bounds of the little complex that it was in, and that's how it started.
It was on Clay Street, is that right, the original?
Yes.
When
correct.
Did it move to the Fish Plaza downtown?
Well, that's been questionable. We think it's been one of those
early
things.
90s, we think 93.
Oh, no. Yeah. No written record. Oh.
No written record on that one, so.
No, but I mean, as long as the weather's fine, I think, you know, that's the best place to have it. But I understand this year that you have an alternative venue if it gets rained out or if the weather's bad.
Yes, we do. We have been really fortunate to be able to partner with Rock Bar Mosaic, which is a nightclub that's in the Bayou Palace downtown, which is right across the street from the Wortham Center, right across the street from where we have our event. So even if it comes a horrible downpour like it did five years ago.
Yeah.
On our 25th anniversary, we will still have the party. It will still go on, and it'll be right across the street, so no one even has to try to figure out where to go.
Yeah, I've really had some weather issues in the last couple of years. I remember the one year, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, when it was so cold.
Yeah, but we're not going to think about that this year.
No,
it's going to be beautiful, sunny, and nice 80-degree temperature.
Yeah, we'll have the anti-rain dance or the anti-bad weather dance.
Exactly.
Talking about the bad weather, last year was one of the years that it wasn't the weather wasn't that bad for the event itself, but at 4 in the morning when I was at your jungle after-hours event trying to determine what was going to happen because it was 40-something degrees, and it was blowing rain. And then by 6:30 that morning, we were having conference calls trying to figure out what was going on. At 7 a.m., Christian, I have to admit, Christian's the person, and he was like, we are going to the site. We're going to stand out there and see what's happening. We were standing in a circle, and all of a sudden, the skies just opened up, and the sun started to peek through.
God wants bunnies on the bayou. That's what I remember that Dan Mader had like live weather conferencing and everything.
It's always been the biggest challenge that we face every year. It's not a matter of raising the funds. It's always how is the weather going to be, and that's been our biggest issue every year. And this year, thankfully, we do have a rain venue, so that won't be an issue. So it'll be a fun-filled weekend in partnership with Jungle.
Yes, that's what I kind of want to mention and kind of talk about. A lot of people get confused when bunnies and jungle come up. I get asked. I'm a jungle co-chair and vice president of Bayou City Boys Club, and they're like, oh yeah, you put on bunnies. And I'm like, well, no, that's another organization. And in years past, it's been two separate organizations putting on events the same weekend, same beneficiaries sometimes, and there was no mention of each other in marketing. And I thought that was kind of peculiar because, you know, Houston is more cohesive than that. I think the community, you know, that's not representative of Houston, but I think in the last couple of years we've started to work together in building this bridge between Bunnies on the Bayou and BCBC and Jungle.
In order to make any event successful, you need to have the partnerships and building a relationship to get the out-of-towners in and just to promote it as an entire weekend. You can't be Bunnies on the Bayou without being BCBC and Jungle. So that's where it, the past few years, it's been wonderful because we can advertise it and promote it as a weekend event.
Yes, and we kind of, in Jungle and BCBC, we kind of go more after the out-of-towners, and we do more of a nationwide promotion. And so when we include that as part of the offering for the weekend, I mean, that just adds value, and, you know, it makes people more likely to come here. And inevitably, that raises more money for the beneficiaries, and that's kind of what we're all about.
That's the root cause, is raising money for the beneficiaries that we select every year.
That's a wonderful segue. Who are the beneficiaries this year for Bunnies?
This year, Bunnies on the Bayou is wonderful and pleased to have AIDS Foundation, their Stone Soup program, as one of our beneficiaries, the Assisters, Bering Omega, their dental clinic, Cult 45s, which they're back on the board again this year, which is great, Lazarus House, Legacy Community Health Services, the Montrose Counseling Center, ICOH, Space City Empire, the Lexi Bowen Fund, SNAP, the Spay and Neuter Assistance Program, and the Buyers Club. So, few new ones on this year, and a few ones that we've all been very familiar with.
What other changes will we see this year with Bunnies?
Bunnies is this year, it's really about the event and raising money. It's very streamlined, this is our second year for our Camp Bunny.
Mm-hmm. Tell the listeners about that.
Camp Bunny is kind of, some of the others can speak a little bit more eloquently about the P-Town experience, but it's kind of like that camp.
Actually, it was Fire Island.
Fire Island.
Sorry to correct you on here. Yeah,
we have gay listeners, and they know the difference between P-Town and Fire Island. So
yeah, the idea came back when a group of our members had came back from Fire Island who had attended a couple of different years. The cabanas that are set up at Fire Island, they were like, we can take that idea. We can make that work for Bunnies on the Bayou. And it was like, okay, interesting idea. How's this going to work? And it just worked itself out last year. It turned out to be a total success.
Those were really cute. I remember going through, and like each one was decorated differently, and I was like, oh, that's
good. Yeah, what we do, we have up to a maximum number of 10 by 20 tents, and whenever you are a Camp Bunny sponsor, you sponsor your own tent, you are allowed 10 VIP passes, and you're giving a private bartender a table and a tent, and then it's up to each individual sponsor to decorate the interior of their tents however they wish. We have a few small limitations, but pretty much it's anything goes. And then there's a contest with all of our VIP attendees that vote, and to find out who is, you know, who has the best tent. So it's a lot of fun all the way around.
And you have the competitive vibe going, and like, oh, who has the best tent? You know, like, oh.
It really does, and it creates, as you come in the plaza, it really creates that atmosphere of really welcoming you as well, and getting the activity all across the board, because not only is the DJ playing great music, but it's also all the way down to the bayou, all the way up to the top of the Wortham Plaza. So it's really spread the entire crowd out to enjoy.
You mentioned DJ. Who's the DJ this year?
This year we have DJ Kerry Stringfellow. He is 1992 as manager of the Salt Lake First Super Club. He's been around for many, many years. He opened Club Axis. He has been working in New York, Los Angeles, all over. His most recent thing, he's currently a mainstay and resident in U.S. in Mexico City. He's close to the Folsom Street Fair and the Real Bad 2007 party in San Francisco. So, again, a lot of events nationwide, so we're very pleased to have them.
Now, I know in years past you used to have a local DJ, and in the last couple of years you've kind of gone more national. What's kind of been the drive behind that, and what direction are you headed with that?
Again, trying to pull in the out-of-town, trying to get national DJ to really bring in an attendance to make it really more of a to tie in with the whole weekend, a party atmosphere, and just really opening up to have our attendees experience new and different DJs every year.
Exactly. Now, for the listeners, if there are any out there that have not attended a Bunnies on the Bayou, tell us where it is, where can they get tickets, what's the time frame? Give us all the 411.
Well, like we said, it is an annual Easter Sunday event. So this year will be Sunday, March 23rd from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. downtown at the Wortham Center, actually in Fish Plaza. So it's actually a wonderful site. It has goes all the way down to the bayou. The tickets are on sale at MTM and on M2M Fashions and online at our website, bunniesonthebayou.org.
Yeah, and that's just all one big bunniesonthebayou.org. It's a little wordy, but that's the website. And yeah, we've been billed for the last several years as the largest outdoor cocktail party in the Southwest. And when the weather's great, it's fantastic. And when the weather's a little cool, we seem to put on jackets and go out and have a good time anyway.
You know, I remember the year it was called the Houston Flyboys were there, and they were in their little outfits, and it was cold.
They amazed the world out of me. I swear, I don't know how they did it, but they did it, and they had a great time doing it. So if they can do it, and we're out there in our jackets all covered up, so, you know, it's a great mix.
Yeah, and definitely I want to thank the Flyboys. They have been really a big part of our Easter celebration for several years now, and they will be again this year as well. So
very good. Okay, well, I think we should maybe give some light on the jungle portion of the show. I am a jungle co-chair, and I am also vice president of Bayou City Boys Club, and we are a separate organization, nonprofit. We put on the jungle party and other events throughout the year, but we also are on Easter weekend, so it kind of ties into Bunnies, and we've always kind of tried to work together in the last couple of years. But ours is a weekend long series of events, starting on Thursday night, Friday, Saturday after hours, and then Sunday. So the idea is to bring in the out-of-town guest, and we try to go for a national DJ, and this year we have DJ Mark Anthony from Montreal. He is best known for the Black and Blue Festival in Montreal. If you go to our website, which I did, so I'm kind of responsible for, junglehouston.com, it has all the information about the events and the beneficiaries that we have. And I don't have the list with me right now, so sorry, listeners. You can go to the website, junglehouston.com, and check that out. The Thursday night event will be at Meteor with DJ Seth Cooper. Friday night will be at South Beach with DJ Hector Fonseca. Saturday night is our main event, is at Warehouse Live with DJ Mark Anthony. And if you haven't been to Warehouse Live, it's really a very unique venue, and it's mostly for concerts, and it seems to be a very good fit for Jungle. So we're very happy there. We have a special room for our VIP lounge, where we have our wonderful silent auction and kind of a way to get away from the crowds. And then, of course, we have our Jungle After Hours, which will be at Club Next with DJ Allison Klagna. And then Sunday night, we have our closing party at South Beach with David Knapp. And I want to interject that this year, Bunnies is going to have an after party. Tell us about that.
That's something that's just recently we've been able to finalize and work out. And Rock Bar Mosaic is going to be our rain venue, as well as they will be the official host of the After Bunnies party, which will start immediately following the end of our main event. So basically, we're just going to move the party across the street. DJ Chad Guidry is going to be our DJ for that, and that is running from 6 until close, whatever. Basically, the way it usually goes is we'll transition from the After Bunnies party to the Jungle After Party and just wrap the weekend up and have a good time.
So if you had the energy and stamina, you could literally go from Thursday to Sunday night with a whole series of events. Again, the website for Jungle is junglehouston.com, and Bunnies on the Bayou, their website is
bunniesonthebayou.org.
And all of this is going to happen starting March 20th, ending on March 23rd, which is Easter Sunday. And is there anything else we want to let the listeners know?
Just come out, get ready to spread your pocketbook, support our beneficiaries, and like I said, if you have the stamina, enjoy all the events. It is a fun-filled weekend, and we do truly enjoy it. And we look forward to spending our time with Jungle just as much as they enjoy spending the time with Bunnies on the Bayou.
Absolutely, and if it wasn't for all of the people that have supported both organizations over the years, there are a lot of our charities in the community that really would not be able to do a lot of the good work that they do. So
it really is a weekend of community events where we give back to the community. And I think over the last couple of years, it's been like $100,000 raised between the two organizations. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it really, if you haven't attended either one of the events, I really encourage you to come out and celebrate. And if the weather's great, I mean, Bunnies on the Bayou is the place to be, especially if, you know, the weather is nice. I mean, there's shirtless men galore. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed that.
You know, I think the first time that I went to Bunnies on the Bayou, well, that was a long time ago. First and only time that I went, actually.
You were what, 10 years old then?
Yeah, exactly. And I was really struck by the great big Easter bonnets.
Do they do that anymore? It seems kind of like...
It's not as prevalent as it used to be. There are still some really good costumes that come out, but it's always great to go to our website, and there we have an entire photo section of past years, and it's fun to just look at all of the different costumes.
Didn't they used to have a bonnet contest back in the day?
And that could be an idea for Bunnies 30, so our 30th
anniversary. Y'all have to really
start building your bonnet now.
Glenn, did you win the bonnet contest?
I did not, no. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show because I thought they still did that. But I was really surprised, let's say surprised, when the first time I went to anything like that, first time I'd ever seen, you know, a 6'5" man with a hairy chest and a full beard in a dress and high heels.
Wearing another 2-foot-tall bonnet.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, well, this evening we had J.D. Doyle interviewing Martin Singer, who's going to be in town this week.
That's all right. We had Jeff Reed. He's our political beat reporter with Glenn Holt.
Joan Devlin interviewed Billy Clift about his book, Diary of a Mad Hairdresser, which will be soon to be a major motion picture.
Yeah, and if you missed earlier, we had an announcement on the Trett Fury shows that are going to be on the 16th and the 17th. Contact information is Deborah. You can call her at 832-771-1903 or email her at thedivadeb@yahoo.com.
And, of course, we spoke to the president and treasurer of Bunnies on the Bayou and myself, the Jungle Co-Chair, about Easter weekend, which is coming up in less than 6 weeks, so it's kind of scary.
Thank you, Bryans. And coming up next week, we're actually going to be in fundraising, but we're still doing the show, so be sure to tune in. We're going to have something called Girl Shorts TV, and I don't know what that is, but hey, we'll find out together, okay? And also, we're going to have the Lone Star Volleyball Association is going to be here to talk about the start of the new season, about the Lone Star Volleyball Classic Tournament coming up, and about the Miss LSVA pageant, which will be coming up the weekend after this one that we just passed. And also, Starbucks is going to be doing their fourth annual silent auction. That's the Starbucks on Hawthorne in the gay neighborhood here. And so we're going to find out more about that. And that's next week on Queer Voices. You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Have you ever wanted to discover what KPFT is like during its most energetic moments? Now is your chance. In just a few weeks, KPFT kicks off its winter pledge drive, and we need your help to make it a success. You can put your spare time to use this February by volunteering to answer phones during the drive. Our phone volunteer trainings are February 10th at 11 a.m. and Wednesday, February 13th at 6 p.m. The sessions will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard. In just an hour or two, you can help us handle pledges. Your efforts make a big difference and can make this a fun and successful drive. Evenings and weekends are available. Again, those phone volunteer training dates are February 10th at 11 a.m. and Wednesday, February 13th at 6 p.m. Visit kpft.org to our...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.